A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we are discussing another humbling defeat for Manchester United and asking what on earth it means for Erik ten Hag. We'll also be debating a World Cup in Saudi Arabia, answering a few listeners' questions and looking ahead to Tottenham versus Chelsea. Joining me, Tom Clark, for all of that is the chief correspondent for The Times and Sunday Times, Martin Samuel, a former striker who scored 248 goals in 620 club appearances, Tony Cascarino, and a former defender who scored 4 goals in 360 club appearances, Gregor Robertson.
They were all crackers, though.
But stopped many more.
Thanks, man. Yeah,
sorry. You had a good one the other week with the whole Xavi and Iniesta thing. Yeah. So, you know, I just wanted to bring you back down to earth. Gentlemen, another day, another show, and another opening gambit where we wonder, what else can we say about Manchester United? Beaten 3-0 by a brilliant Newcastle side in the EFL Cup. Lost again at home. Martin, my opening question is, are we at the stage now where we're asking about Erik ten Hag's future?
No, not in the least, because we're all waiting for a chap who's got 25% of the club to turn up and tell us all what to do and where it's going to go. And that's where Manchester United are now. And it's the most ridiculous situation, not because I particularly want Erik ten Hag to be out of work, but simply because that isn't even an option. There is. I don't think any situation that Manchester United could get themselves into in the next couple of months, and unless maybe they lost every single game or something like that, where they would make a decision on whether Erik ten Hag is the right man, because everyone is sitting around waiting for a guy to turn up and ostensibly run the football operations, who has got 25% of the club. It's like not being able to sell your house until you've heard from Bernie, the lodger in the spare room, on what he wants you to do about it. Because it's you know, this is a club that has got to function for many weeks, many months, whilst we wait for this. Well, it's not a takeover, is it? It's a you know, this buy-in to take place, where we are told, or it is being briefed, that he will have, you know, Ineos will have this great say over football matters and football affairs and everything. But we don't know that. That seems to be coming very much from the Ineos camp, and, you know, they would say that, wouldn't they? So in terms of what happens with Erik ten Hag, well, he carries on unless someone wants to do something very, very radical, like take advice from a bloke who doesn't even own, as far as I can see, a season ticket at the moment, let alone a shareholding or whatever.
Quite tricky to get a United season ticket, to be fair to you.
Yeah.
Almost as tricky as getting 25% of the club.
I was going to say, not if you're a billionaire, it's not. I wouldn't have thought. You know, I was at Andy Murray's Wimbledon, you know, the first Wimbledon he won. Rupert Murdoch was sitting right in the front row in one of the greatest seats in Centre Court. So I would think,
and he got it in the ballot. I heard.
Well, yeah, exactly. I would think if you've got a bit of money and influence, you can get a ticket.
I'm sure you're right.
Everyone's delighted.
Tony,
that analogy.
Martin's obviously making the point about Jim Ratcliffe and the protracted takeover situation. it's something that Gregor has talked about before. When he, you know, it's a good caveat, it's a good asterisk, isn't it, around our analysis of Manchester United. But just putting that to one side for a minute, the performances on the pitch. And I wanted to ask you as well, because it's something as we talked about on Monday show, Ten Hag's comments about this side can't play like my Ajax side. They're made for more direct football. Yeah. This week, to me, in my, you know, in my editing chair, when, you know, we be mischievous and try and create trouble for people, this feels to me like a week where it's starting to slip away from him a little bit. Would you agree?
Yeah. I think that's been happening for a long time. You only have to watch the opening game of the season against Wolves, then you immediately alarm bells are ringing. I look at a guy that I sort of reminds me of the Riddler from Batman, because he says things like he did last week, that this team has moved forward. And I'm like, well, I can't see that. I must be watching different performances. I look at him bringing players. And I was saying to Gregor before we came on that last night, I just thought I'd have a look over the transfers since he's been there. You know, we know he spent over 400 million. OK, but then you look at what players have been sold for, and you think, well, it's a lot of 15 million sales, like Elanga left for 15 million, you know, and then Dean Henderson went for 15 million. You know, these are Man United players. Okay, they might not be good enough. And then you spend 50s and 60s and 70s on your players that you buy. The vultures hang over clubs when they overperform and they achieve. Just look at Brighton, look at Brentford and other clubs. They're examples that when you're looking at their players, the vultures of other clubs looking over, we'll have him, we'll take him, Declan Rice at West Ham, we'll go and pay this. You know, that's what happens. I don't know of any player at Man United, and you'll probably have to say maybe Marcus Rashford, but who would be hanging over looking at them players to think, I'll take him, I'll take him. Hmm. I see loanees coming into the club that are Reguilon. I see Johnny Evans walk into a team. I ain't against a senior pro coming into a young side that is developing. Gary McAllister did that at Liverpool. He came in alongside Steven Gerrard, made a massive impact. I don't have a problem with that. But I have a problem with Johnny Evans coming to the club. Not because he's not a good player. He is. But I have a problem coming into quite clearly a dysfunctional dressing room. I mean, I still think Ronaldo got a lot right about where Man United are. I'm talking about the guy that was an incredible professional. Now, you might not go along that road and say, well, the disruption at Man United. Well, maybe that disruption started a long time ago of what was happening. And we're seeing loads off the field. We're not seeing performances on it. And I think you can look at the whole state of the club. And I'm just stunned, because last night I'm watching and I wasn't surprised. Newcastle, and you said about, you know, giving credit, or we talk about credit. Newcastle changed their goalkeeper, their whole back four, a couple in midfield, and Isak or Wilson didn't play up front. You know, and I know Man United made changes, but they're really 80% second
team. That was, I mean, some teams last night didn't play a Carabao Cup team. West Ham was pretty much their first team. And a couple of others as well. But Newcastle, that is the absolute embodiment of their Carabao Cup team.
Yeah.
That really is. The 11 they put out against Manchester United last night.
Some ain't played for ages.
And they murdered them. Absolutely murdered them.
But that's why I kind of come back to Ten Hag, because you make excellent points about the off-field situation. Kaz, you're making points about players who are decreasing, if you like, in how attractive they are.
But how much of that is Ten Hag's fault?
No, but I'm just talking purely about that. These recent performances, you can factor all that in. But you know, you guys have been in dressing rooms. You tell me, that has to be a managerial thing, doesn't it? What instructions is he actually giving that team at the minute, both tactically and motivationally? That's what I'm trying to come to, because we've talked a lot about the off the field situation. We've talked a lot about the transfers and things. I'm trying to think about what is new, and what feels new to me is that this week it feels like we've moved slightly away from going, yeah, but the poor bloke can't do anything about it.
Well, I think the thing is something that Martin wrote about actually this week about him contradicting himself about, you know, when he first arrived, we saw he tried to play this brand of football that we'd recognised at Ajax, and he quickly realised they weren't good enough to do it. Part of that was about not having a goalkeeper who could start building from the back, so he changed it this year, and it looked like they tried to do it again this year, and he's realised again pretty quickly that they're not good enough to do it. So, well, that's his argument. You argued very articulately that's maybe not.
I think they're better than that. I do think they're better than, you know, we've got a Manchester United team that can't pass. I don't think that's true. But sorry.
I absolutely take your point, but I also think that when you're in a dressing room, and Tony will maybe recognise this, if you as a kind of group of players are hearing that message, or even like he's tried to do it twice, he's tried to change it twice, and the results haven't been forthcoming. It sort of is a bit of a dent to the team's sort of confidence, I would suggest. But I sound like a broken record on this. You just still look through their team, and all the things that Tony was speaking about are true. But they're not Ten Hag's fault.
But this is what I'm coming to.
But the team on the pitch matters, Tom. They've got Sergio Reguilón playing left back. They've got Hannibal, who in any other Manchester United era would never have had a first team appearance at Old Trafford, and he's running around like a maniac. They've got Anthony, who he signed from Ajax, but he signed him from Ajax because there's no structure around him. There's no functioning recruitment department. There's no sporting director. Gary Neville referenced last night where, you know, he was walking up to the gantry and he met Dan Ashworth on the way. Dan Ashworth, who has a track record at the FA, at Brighton, has joined Newcastle, done really good work everywhere. And in the 18 months or whatever it is that the Saudi Arabian investment has arrived at Newcastle, they've already done more to implement and build a structure at that football club than the Glazers have done in a decade. All that matters.
Absolutely,
that's
matters.
Why there's dysfunction on the pitch.
It absolutely matters. All I'm saying is these are topics that we've covered before and we'll cover again with Manchester United. I just feel like with the Manchester City game, with the changes he made at halftime that we talked about, and then in this game, you know, we've praised Newcastle for what they are and what they stand for under Eddie Howe, and Martin's quite rightly highlighted that that's basically their second team and a lot of changes. How is it not for players in the dressing room, regardless of what on the pitch, and if you're looking around thinking, why the hell is that Hannibal lad in the team? He's useless. But are you not expecting some kind of direction, both in terms of tactics and motivation from the manager at this low moment? And if you're not getting it, that's his fault.
Who says they're not getting it? They're not producing it.
The displays suggest that they're not getting it.
Yeah, but how many head coaches have they done that? This group of players, largely speaking, how many head coaches with good reputations have had this happen to them?
But half of them, Gregor, are his signings. Yeah. I mean, the goalkeeper's his.
Martinez is his, isn't he? Okay, he's not there last night, but he was injured. There's the same problems. Casemiro's his signing. Amrabat's a player he's brought out.
He's signing.
Amrabat has Highland come off twice after signing. 45 minutes.
Why are they signing Amrabat? They're signing another loan player because of the dysfunction at the football club.
Yeah, but
they're signing
Reguilón
on loan because of that. They signed Sabitzer last year on loan because of that. They signed Wout Weghorst on loan because of that. They're a shambles. Well, he shouldn't have as much influence over the signings as he does.
Well, but Amrabat's not a bad player. I mean, there's a lot of people that will tell you that Amrabat was the real player of the World Cup. You know, and what he did for Morocco in getting them as far as they did. He was the player of the World Cup.
But there's maybe a reason. Why after that Sterling display and everyone was like, "Wow, who's this?" No one signed him.
Tony.
Yeah. Just a quick one, right? All of us think about this, right? You train all week. You prepare your team. So you've got 25 professionals, right? You do your drills. You organise your set of your team. Can you any of us find a way of explaining how Man United play?
No, I can't. And that's kind of my point recently, and that's where I'm trying to bring the conversation
that is a manager
back to Eric Ten Hag.
That's a manager.
Yeah.
Because if you've got 25 pros, you must be able to find a way of that team performing to some level. It might not be the very best, but it's a way that looks like their team look organised. They can make it difficult for the opposition. They can hurt the opposition. I look at Ten Hag's team and I'm like, I don't really know how they play.
Tony, I use this analogy. I don't know if I've used it on here. I've certainly used it in columns and stuff like that. You could send Manchester City out in white T-shirts, not a single marking on them, and after 5 minutes you'd go, that's Pep Guardiola's Manchester City.
Yeah.
And you could do the same with Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool. You'd need 5 minutes and you'd go, oh yeah, that's a Liverpool team managed by Jurgen Klopp. You would know it. Manchester United, you would need the red shirt, you'd need the crest, you'd need a team sheet. You need a name on the back, and then you'd be able to recognise them as Manchester United. They haven't got that identity that a good team has. You could argue you can do it in Newcastle. You can argue you can do it with Arsenal. You could certainly do it with David Moyes. Certainly do it with Villa. You could certainly do it with any David Moyes team. You can go, oh yeah, that's a David Moyes team. You can't do it with Manchester United. It's funnily enough, the only identity that they have had this season is the one that Ten Hag has just given them, where he's basically said, we're a long ball team because I can't trust them to pass it. And if I was Harry Maguire, when Harry Maguire came into the England team, one of the reasons that he was lauded, one of the reasons that people thought, we've got a good centre-half here, is because he did the old-fashioned English centre-half thing. He was strong in the air. He was a big, imposing fella. But he wanted to bring the ball out from the back. He wanted to break into midfield. And I'm not saying it always looked like Beckenbauer, because it didn't. But it didn't look like he couldn't play. It didn't look like the man couldn't play. So for him to hear that the manager thinks that pretty much they can't play must be quite dispiriting. Really,
how would you do your columns? Maguire. How would you do your columns if the head of sport, you know, you both do columns. if you knew the guy, if the guy up top thought you didn't do it very well, how would you respond to that? Or kept lecturing you of how?
No, I completely agree with that. Absolutely.
That is just.
But fundamentally,
I just wanted to come in off the back of what Martin said there and think about Martin's opening point about waiting for Jim Ratcliffe. Because I think I want you to understand, Gregor, and because you're representing the kind of, I think the Manchester United fan who is in defence of Erik ten Hag because of the shambles off the pitch, and I'm sure there'll be lots of listeners who are United fans thinking the same thing. I'm not trying to point at Erik ten Hag and say he's the problem, but thinking about Martin's point at the start about Jim Ratcliffe and waiting, and Tony's point about what's their identity. What I'm saying is that his bit, where he could have said, right, let's just be really solid, because I've not got the players, and I've not got a good enough setup, and I've not got a technical director to find me the best players in Liga and La Liga. I'm going to do my bit, and I'm just going to keep coming out, and maybe I'll lose 2-1 to Newcastle, but we'll play all right, and we'll look all right, but I've still got Reggie on, etc. I just feel like it's got to, recently, this season, increasingly, he's not doing his part of what is a very messed up situation. All the other bits can remain messed up, waiting for Jim Ratcliffe, poor signings, poor squad. But his bit, it's, you know, the PR game that we talk about so much, his bit, the chat in interviews where he says funny things like, we're a long ball team and I'll never play like Ajax. Hang on a minute, I thought you were hired for that. And the performances on the pitch where you're looking at it and going, what the hell are you doing here? What's your plan, mate? That's where I'm coming from. I almost want him to be doing those things so that we can defend him and say, give this bloke the time. But he's not helping himself, is what I'm kind of getting at. And that's where I'm posing the question. Is he on borrowed time now a little bit?
I think he's, you know, of all the problems that Manchester United have, he's at risk of becoming another one of them, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, because he'll know himself that this is always the balance. If you've always got to get enough points, enough wins, enough results to get the time to change the club, and he's already had a lot of time, and like this season they've taken a massive backward step. But if you're talking about why don't we play, have a disciplined performance and stuff like that, look at the front four last night. Garnacho, Anthony, Hannibal and Martial. Do you think you're going to get much discipline out of that mob?
But isn't that also his responsibility?
But then we're saying Amrabat, he brought him off at half time the last game. Then they brought him on at half time in this game. Casemiro was kicking people. He's not fit. Like he doesn't have the pieces to put in the puzzle.
But he's
been there
a while to make them disciplined and get those situations.
No one's made Martial disciplined. Garnacho, I'm not sure he'll ever be disciplined either. He might be good enough on the other side to make it worthwhile. You say, okay, we'll play him because my God, he's a maverick. Mm. That's still yet to be seen. Anthony, look, that's a big thing. That's a big stick that people will continue to beat Ten Hag with. Hannibal, well, I don't know. He's seen some endeavour.
How would you play against Anthony? You're fullback.
I'd let him do his
exactly.
his frivolous step.
That's what they're all doing,
just
Gregor.
Keep him in front of me, yeah.
All the fullbacks with who play against Anthony are going, do what you want to do, and all your fancy stuff, and then I'll win the ball when I need to. Because that's what he's doing. Every time he gets it, he does these step over. I mean, he's like a terrible version of Ronaldo. When he, you know, when Ronaldo had that. I mean, is there a bad version of Ronaldo? I don't know.
It's a fair analogy.
Do you know what I mean? It's like you for a fullback are so easy to play against.
And by the way, they got hold of Ronaldo because Ronaldo was, you know, seven step overs and everything like that. And Ferguson and the rest of the team got hold of him and went, no. You don't do that here. Yeah. We don't do that here. And if you remember, his first great game is against Millwall in the FA Cup, when you suddenly look at it and they win 3-0 and they go, and you look at him and go, oh no, this is a player. And that was a much more pared down, less showy version of Ronaldo. And he was never like it again. He took on board everything that he learned as a young player at Manchester United, because he's smart. And he went forward with that. The point I was making about the Jim Ratcliffe situation is they have somehow contrived to get themselves into another season like the one where they sacked Ole Gunnar Solskjaer and brought in an interim coach that, I must admit, when I first saw who it was and you read what everyone was saying about him, I thought, oh, this is what they need. They want this very, very technical coach, and this is what they've lacked under Ollie. They don't look a particularly coached team, and they look as if it's a little bit thrown together. Now they've got precision. Now they have someone who'll, you know, drill them. And, of course, that season sort of passed by in a fog, basically. And they seem to have got themselves potentially into that situation again, where they're all hanging around waiting for this chap to turn up with his team of wizards and, you know, sort the transfer policy out and sort the direction of the football club out, which isn't going to happen in a transfer window, because it never happens in a transfer window. Not in one. And I know elite clubs can change very, very quickly. Arsenal show us that. That they went from, oh, they've got no chance, to, oh, suddenly they're title contenders. So you can change things very quickly with enough money, and if you're an elite club, if you're big enough, etc. But there seems so much wrong with Manchester United that you look at that and think, this is a good year, 2-3 transfer windows away from becoming a team that is where Manchester United would want to be. So, and at the moment, they're just drifting, and they haven't even started that process yet. Mm-hmm. It's not the next two transfer windows. It's probably this summer would be the first one under the Ratcliffe administration, and then there's the next transfer. You know, you're talking about another 18 months.
Yeah, or maybe more.
Martin. Or maybe more. I mean, and that's if a bloke who's got 25% of the club, he's given the keys to the train cell.
Absolutely. Lots
whatever
of,
the metaphor there
lots,
is.
Lots of ifs. And we've had a lot of analogies as well. Yeah. Riddler and Bobby the Lodger and all sorts.
All sorts. Plus me slurping my coffee. I've been told off by Neil.
It's all right.
Those little holes, I can never get... Why?
Be careful what you say.
Yeah, I know. You put the lid on and I've never been good. I've never been good with them.
Too much caffeine. That's what's getting us excited. Gregor, Martin's talked about... Cristiano Ronaldo and, you know, an improving a player there, and referenced also Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. And one of the things he did when he came in, as much as his tactics were limited, he did give a lot of players confidence. And so that was one of the things he was praised for. He's given them the Manchester United identity. Do you think Erik ten Hag has improved or given any player or players anything extra since he's taken over?
He's already been through that cycle, that stage of the cycle.
I know, but I'm asking who
Dalot,
he did.
Diego Dalot. But then it's kind of reverting to the mean again a little bit for Dalot again. I can't pick out many more, to be honest. Anyone else want to pitch in?
No, yeah, well, I would have said, look, there was
Bruno got back to something again, actually, last
season.
Isn't
that what he should have been doing, though?
Well, Rashford was the one last season.
Yeah.
You know, that was a big...
Rashford, of course, sorry.
Rashford was the big one last year. But I would be more concerned about Rasmus Højlund, because I can see a player starting to go the wrong way. Even though he came on as a sub last night, but his performances, where there was a lot of hope built that Man United would be fine. Once he gets going, there's a player there you can see.
Well, those two goals in the Champions League were excellent.
But I'm not sure, with it all falling and going in one direction, that he'll get dragged down with it. Because that looks inevitable to me.
Right. But you touched on Marcus Rashford there, Tony. I wanted to ask you, former striker, obviously there was news stories this week about him going out on a night out after the Manchester derby. Yeah. I'm always fascinated by these stories, because as a journalist and editor myself, I'm like, that's a great story. What's he done that for? What an idiot. But then as a person myself, I thought, if I'd had a bad day at work, you know, the worst day possibly have, I might go out as well, treat myself to a nice meal or something, a few cocktails, cheer myself up.
It was his birthday, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was his birthday.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so give us the striker's view on that, because I know you've got a story from your career as well about going out.
Been there, done it. Yeah, and probably done it too often. And yeah, defeats. Look, we were in a world that, first of all, it was happening quite a lot at many different clubs. I always say the demise of Liverpool from the 80s to you know, winning everything, and got to the 90s, and then Fergie turned up, totally changed everything about Man United. And you just see that by the players that left the football club that he deemed a problem, certainly socialising and going out, and that changed. And then Liverpool started to go downwards. I had an experience with Don Howe, the great Don Howe. He was assistant to Ian Portfield at Chelsea. And he turned up. It was towards the mid-season, and we went on Ireland to a trip, and I was injured, and I went out on the last night before we came back in Cork. And I got in at 2 in the morning, and he spotted me in the reception. He went, can I have a word with you tomorrow morning at the airport? And I was like, okay. So he's left me stewing now, but thinking, what is it about? And I know it's because...
So did he just happen to be there? Or
he was up. He was watching people come in. He was... Don had eyes everywhere. Don would have been making sure... Right, last day trip, they've gone out. I'm going to wait until I see who comes in and what people might not be necessary next season. Mm. Anyway, so I get to the airport. I'm thinking, right, Don's going to have a go at me. I've been out. But I only had a couple, and I say only, but I did go out. And Don's immediately approached me and said, he said, at the Cascarino, I watched play against Adams and Keown against Arsenal when you and Sheringham are up front. He said, where is he? So I said, what do you mean, Don? I said, I know I'm injured on the trip, but I'm, you know, I'm still trying to fight to get fit. He said, no. He said, you've had a few moves, haven't you? And he didn't swear once in this conversation, by the way. He didn't say one effing or me. I mean, he said, you've had a few moves, didn't you? And I said, yeah, Villa and Celtic, Don, yeah. He went, do you make a few quid? And I went, well, yeah, obviously moves, yeah. He went, looks like it.
Mm.
So I've said, look, Don... I said, look, Don, I know you've only just come to the club and whatever, but I have, you know, trying to be as good as I can. And he said to me, look, I'll give you an option. How old are you? And I said, well, I'm just coming up to 31, Don. And he said, you're training Monday morning, aren't you? And I said, yeah. He said, 2 o'clock, Monday afternoon, me and you, one-on-one. We're going to have a training session, just me and you. And I'm thinking, really? Just me and you? And he's gone...
And yeah. You'd never do that. That's basically unheard of.
Don was there for everybody. The kids, the older players. That I worked on them one-on-one. I got back in the team. He told me we had loads of conversations during that period where me and Don would sit down after the training session privately with him. How he saw me. Still felt I had a career. Still felt I had something to offer. He told me that he'd spoke to Porters about me, Ian Portfield. And I had a really good end to the season. I turned Chelsea around from being the fans, not the favourite, not getting a bit of stick. And he also lectured me on your responsibility of not going out for any reason. Now, it's a different world for Marcus Rashford, but I wouldn't... If I was sitting to him now and saying, Marcus, this is obvious, this, such a short career, whatever you do, just... If you're going to have a drink, go back to your own house, have some people round, don't go out to China White's. Okay, don't go out because you're just asking for trouble. It is a different world. But I could give you loads more that Don said to me, and it was all done with trying to make me understand how privileged I was to be a footballer, and you will never get this time back again. So don't waste it. I ended up playing from 31 to 38. I stood by every word Don had told me.
And did you adapt your kind of going out and stuff? I'm not saying you then immediately stopped it. But you did.
I stopped it completely. Yeah. I had to realise I needed to stop being one of the lads, because I was the one that... I always battled a bit with my weight anyway. A really brief story. Me and Sheringham went away to Lanzarote with Millwall, and I roomed with him, and I decided, because he had a six-pack and was just incredibly fit, I thought, I'm going to eat and drink everything he does for the whole week. Right. So we were training in Lanzarote. Me and him, I every breakfast meal was exactly the same as Teddy's. When he had a drink, I had a drink.
What was he having then? Like,
I was just Teddy was having just normal, a bit of fry up and all that. And I was, I was picking. We came away from that week. I weighed myself at the old den. I put on 6 pounds and he'd lost 2.
Right? Can't fight that metabolism, can you?
No. Well, it. years down the line, I had an underactive thyroid and Teddy had an overactive one, which I mean, didn't matter too much because I wouldn't have cared. But my whole idea, what I'm trying to say is, I got 7 years extra on my career all because of that one meeting. If anyone said to me about Marseille, Nancy and everything that happened to me afterwards, playing to Ireland for another 5 years, I would say it was all down to Don Howe because he cared about me. And this is a part that where we talked about with managers and coaches. If you realise that Marcus is a good player and you can get him to play his best football because he did last year, don't let him come off that circus. Get away from it. Away from it. You can do that all after your career if you want to. You can do loads more.
One thing I would say is that maybe, like, I would be even surprised if Marcus Rashford was having a drink at all. The thing is, it's perceptions.
Yes.
It doesn't matter if he did or not, actually, because we're having this conversation. It's just the perception that nowadays you've just booked your birthday party for the night after you're playing in a Manchester derby and your team's not doing very well. It's just the person, you know.
Someone shocked him as well.
Well.
Because it ends up in the papers. Because that's what happens when your team's not doing well. You immediately think, oh, it's probably some Man City fan or whatever, but it possibly not. It's possibly some disgruntled Manchester United fan or whatever that, if they'd have won 3-0, would have loved to be in the same place as Marcus Rashford. But as they got beaten 3-0, has phoned someone up and gone, here, you'll never guess who was in China Whites until the small hours.
That happened to
whatever.
Me at Villa. I went to Ireland on a day, flew in and out. I got back and I only just joined, and Graham Taylor called me in the office. I'd only been there 2 weeks. He went, did you go to Ireland yesterday? And I went, I did. I thought, oh, I can't get out of this. I did. So he went, he said that someone told me you was in at East Midlands Airport.
Mm. There you go.
And it's like the Fergie thing, isn't it? That's what he knew. That's what he found out.
Oh, I mean, we were talking before, and there's the famous story about Alex and turning up at, I'm pretty sure it's Lee Sharp's house.
Yeah, it was Lee
In full evening dress, where he was at a function, and someone said to him, God, there's a party going off at Lee Sharp's house tonight. I live down his road, or whatever. However he came to find out about it. And Fergie gets straight in either a car or in a cab or whatever, suited and booted, evening tie, evening suit and bow tie and everything, and bang, bang, bang on the door, and someone opens the door and it's the manager standing there in formal wear, and the party was shut down, I think, within about 5 minutes, basically, and that was the beginning of the end for a lot of guys, you know. But they were great guys, those Don Howe and Dave Sexton, that era guy, because they would let players let off steam. It wasn't some Spartan regime, but it had to be at the right time. I mean, I used to go on under 21 trips when I started out, and Dave Sexton was the manager, and I can remember one where they won it. The Toulon tournament, they won, and you know, Dave basically said to all the boys that the coach leaves at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning, make sure you're on it. And that was his only instruction about the night, because they'd won the tournament. I think he even said to someone, have the FA given you your regulation condoms, and you know, little jokes like this and stuff. By the same token, in another under 21 tournament where we decided to have a party that was taking place in my room, which was with all the team, and there was about three or four journalists, and we all came back and we had brought all this booze back and stuff like that. And there was a Plymouth goalkeeper, was a guy called Mark Nichols. Can you remember? Peter Shilton championed this guy.
Right, okay.
Terrible, terribly sad story. He died at a very young age. And Mark had a party trick, which is probably not the best party trick for a professional footballer to have, which is that he could smoke 20 cigarettes at once. he'd get the packet and he'd tap them out and he'd put them all in his mouth and he'd light the lot and he'd keep them there and just smoke them all down, basically. And I don't know why it was hysterical, but it was hysterical. And so the party was in full swing. Mark was doing this party piece, the 20 fags at once. He had a bottle of beer in both hands and there was a knock on the door. And he's opened the door and it's Dave Sexton, his goalkeeper, sitting there with 20 fags in his mouth and a bottle of beer in each hand. And I can remember the coating that the players were were given by Dave around the swimming pool the following day. There was the hotel had a swimming pool. And there's some very, very famous names on that trip. Very famous. Guys that had, I mean, fabulous careers. Virtually won everything in football on that trip. And they were all there. And, you know, and that was the different side of Dave, because I think we were one match into the tournament at this stage when this party was taking place. Maybe if we'd have won it and that had been the night after, he would have had no problem with. Maybe he would have had a problem with 20 fags at once.
Yeah, but, I'm sure he might have done. It's something that puts it in context, certainly for Marcus Rashford's little birthday treat after the Manchester derby. Chaps, fascinating debate around Manchester United and some great stories as well from the past. If you're a Manchester United fan and you don't agree with anything we've talked about, or maybe you do agree, I'd be fascinated to hear your thoughts on Erik ten Hag. You can email me tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk. Stick with us. We're going to be talking about the Saudi Arabian World Cup next.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Hello and welcome back to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. I'm Tom Clark and I'm joined by Tony Cascarino, Gregor Robertson and Martin Samuel. Now, up next, I'm going to read the intro to a column by one of the members of the team today. There was a strange sound from the federations and associations when the 2034 World Cup was presented, gift-wrapped to Saudi Arabia this week. Silence. No protests, no armbands, no T-shirts, no statements, no rebellions, no condemnations, not even a hastily convened meeting. There will be a ratification process next year, but with Australia out, it is a formality. This flies. Saudi Arabia wins, FIFA wins, oil money wins, as always. Martin Samuel, that was the start
you
of your...
You stopped short of that, the next line.
Oh, of your gag?
But don't worry.
No, I'm going to have to say it now. The rest of the world will simply lie there and let it wash over them like a golden shower. There you go. just when all the analogies and stories were in
everyone's being lost.
Yeah, people posting at the bottom of that. Does Martin Samuel know what this means? Yes, he does.
Yes, he does. But not onto the joke, onto the substance of that very interesting intro from you from that piece that you wrote on Tuesday. I mean, how do we feel about this Saudi Arabian World Cup, which is now a formality, as you say?
Yeah, it is a formality. Yeah. Well, I feel exactly as I wrote there. Look, it has always been my belief that the federations can resist the sighting of a World Cup, that the federations could have resisted the sighting of the World Cup in Qatar. they could resist this as well. But they won't, because everybody is too indebted to Saudi Arabian money now, as they were to Qatari money. Because if you look at Bein Sports' list of clients, their list of broadcast contracts, you can see why in the end there was no great pushback from the major European nations, because it's the Bundesliga, it's the Premier League, it's La Liga, and it's Serie A, and it's everything, and it's the Champions League. So everybody is involved in Bein Sports. And I'm pretty sure it was in the Times. It might even have been on this page. Yeah, there we go. So there's a study, and it says that Saudi has got 314 separate sports sponsorships at the moment. And that's across all sport. That's not just across football. But that's my point, is that there will be no pushback against this, because the Italian Super Cup has gone to Saudi and become a 4-team tournament. The Spanish Super Cup is in Saudi and is now a 4-team tournament. They own Newcastle United. So everyone is in some way, and everyone likes selling their players to the Saudi Pro League, because, you know, that's got a few out of trouble with financial fair play this summer. So, in the end, there wasn't any great put. You haven't heard a peep out of the various federations this time, and I don't think you will. And everyone will just vote it through.
So do you think there should be, and do you think we can are you suggesting that we can divorce all those things you've outlined, the Super Cups and the Newcastle ownership and things, do you think we are allowed to divorce that from this protest a Saudi Arabian World Cup in a way, and also say it's okay for them to own Newcastle
United? Yeah,
because
one is private business.
Right.
So, one is private business. You see, Newcastle United is private business, same as there is a Saudi interest in Uber, same as there's now a Saudi interest in Disney, all the companies that, it's like saying, oh, you can't protest the Qatar World Cup if you worked for the Times, because they own the building that we're recording this in. Yeah, but one's business. You're not saying that you cannot trade with this country, do any, because fundamentally you can.
Yeah, but are Newcastle not more than a business?
No, they're a business. They're a business. That's what they are. They're Newcastle United Limited. And the distinction I make with the World Cup is a World Cup is a public property, and everyone should be able to feel welcome at the World Cup. Everybody feels welcome at Newcastle United. I mean, if you're gay, you've got a decision to make with your own conscience whether you feel happy going there, and whether it's something that you can attend. It's a place you can attend, happily. But there's no suggestion that you will be made to feel unwelcome or self-conscious or other if you went to St James's Park. None at all. Not exactly the same, perhaps, in Saudi Arabia.
So do you think the World Cup should not be in Saudi Arabia?
Or
do you think there should just
be
some protest?
I don't think the World Cup should be anywhere where everybody can't go and feel happy and feel comfortable and be themselves. As a rule of thumb, if you're serious about it being about the fans and football for all, it should be in places where everyone can feel comfortable and happy.
It's quite. I mean, how many countries in the world are highly dangerous? You know, we go to our next World Cup, which is in America, Mexico, and Canada. Mm-hmm. Now, America's not the safest place, is it? I would say that Mexico's even more dangerous. South America, I know it's Central America, Mexico, but if you look at South America and having World Cups, I'm not sure where you can take the World Cup sometimes.
But I think there's a difference between, like, sort of danger and a criminality type idea of, South Africa was made safe by putting, 50,000 extra policemen or police.
It was a huge police
presence in South Africa, and that rendered the country safe for 5 or 6 weeks in a way that it isn't.
Russia changed as well. They completely changed the, yeah. the way that the country operated while they hosted the World
while
Cup.
While the World Cup.
And then
when
everyone went home, they went back to old Russia.
Oh, but that's what happened, man. That is, the, you know...
I think it's also important to say, to point out that, like, it would be... you would have to go to extreme lengths. Martin's right. Like, countries, we, and other UEFA nations, largely speaking, could kick up a fuss, but they'd have to go to extreme lengths because we're irrelevant now. Because there are 211 member nations. UEFA has 55 votes. And Infantino has worked the room, worked the room enough that he's got almost all of the rest on lockdown. CONCACAF, which is North and Central America, has 41 votes. Africa has 54 votes. The Asian Football Confederation has 47 votes. He's got them all on lockdown. The only other one is South America, but they think they've only got 9 or 10, despite their history.
Yeah, 14. And I think they've got 14, is it?
Is it that many? Okay. So, and they're historically kind of... being able to shift their affiliation. It's also a battle between UEFA and FIFA. Like, that's it.
It is.
Because UEFA FIFA are kind of siding with Saudi Arabia, I think, building a real alliance, to also take on the club game, to take on UEFA's sort of power in the club game. Because UEFA has... you know, as the Champions League, as the European Championship, as so many profitable competitions that dwarf the revenue that the World Cup. The World Cup, I think, generates about €8 billion, and I think UEFA generate about three times that over the same 4-year period from their competitions. So they're now taking them on with the Club World Cup and stuff. So there's so much like politicking taking place here, but the important thing to say is, like, Martin's right, but they would have to almost boycott.
Oh yeah, I mean, this is...
they would have to boycott.
But that is, that's the sort of threat I'm talking about, and which is why the piece was there was a sort of dual points were being made. One, you could stop this, and this is the way to stop it. But two, it ain't going to happen because the boycott is, and that's how they stopped. That's how the UEFA clubs stopped the idea of readmitting Russia. By the back door, the sort of thin end of the wedge, readmittance of Russia, which was going to be in under 17 tournaments. That was going to be the start of it. The Russian age group teams were going to be allowed back into UEFA competition. So they were going to be allowed to try to qualify for the, I think it was the under 17 European Championships. And then that would also, then also be able to qualify for the under 17 World Cup. And to be fair, it was our football association and then football associations from Scandinavian countries and from the Baltic states and obviously from Ukraine itself that said, well, if you do that and they draw us, we're not going to play them. And then this suddenly created a big problem for UEFA, because if Russia progress from the group by default, because the other two or three countries say, well, no, we're not playing them, then they get to the finals itself, and then teams at the finals start saying, well, we're not playing them, then the whole tournament falls apart in front of their eyes.
Yeah.
And so it was meant to be, this readmittance was meant to be ratified by UEFA at their next meeting, and they didn't even put it onto the agenda because it... you know, they were threatened basically with a boycott.
Isn't
the same thing could happen, but it won't.
Could you also imagine the optics when, if the FA was to boycott a World Cup in Saudi Arabia, when Saudi Arabia owned Newcastle United? I know there are a lot of other business ties, but this is actually a direct link tie to the Premier League. So, like. I know we're talking about the world of like business and Saudi Arabian investment in a huge, like hugely diverse range of businesses and industries, but Newcastle was one aspect of a strategy to buy sport. That's why I say fundamentally it matters why Saudi Arabia invested in Newcastle. It matters, and they're not just a private business. They also are something that represent a wider public concern, just like the World Cup does.
I was going to just add it, the finance of it. Well, if you look back at South Africa, which I think was FIFA made about $2.5 billion, would that be right? about 2.5 billion. Mm. By the time it got to Qatar, it was nearly 9.5 billion. Mm. So you look at Saudi Arabia by 34, you're probably talking 20 billion. Mm. So FIFA get caught up in all this as well.
Yeah, I want to come back to Gregor's point about ownership and Manchester City and Newcastle in a minute. But Tony, you obviously played in the 1994 World Cup, and you mentioned
in America.
You know, from the outside, like, that was a tournament that was still trying to showcase America, wasn't it? And they had the glitz and the glamour, and you had Diana Ross missing that penalty and the goal breaking apart. But was that more as innocent as I'm making it out? Or, you know, and for Martin as well, as a journalist at the time, or was there kind of discussions around, this is a bit, we're trying to, you know, sell football to America? Did you feel that as a player going over there? Or was it more innocent?
You left your hotel. I'm sure Martin would have been out there reporting on it. You left your hotel, and if you spoke to anybody in the street, most Americans were asking what was going on.
Yeah.
You got to the games, and there was huge support from everybody. You know, the Island game was the New York Giants Stadium. There was 96,000 there. It was incredible. And other matches.
Biggest attendance is... It's still the biggest attendance in the history of the World Cup. Yeah. 1994 in America. And they cheered, if you remember, Tony, they cheered goal kicks. Yeah. And they cheered if the goalkeeper kicked it out of his hand. Because it sounds very patronising, but in a crowd of 96,000, say, there will only be so many that actually understand
what's going on,
the sport. Mm. In the same way that I've been to an NFL match, and I'm not going to pretend for one second that I really understand NFL, but, you know, I appreciate it being in the stadium. The goalkeeper would kick it out of his hands, and the crowd would cheer as if something really fantastic had happened, because the sports that they were looking, you know, the field sports that they were familiar with, gaining yardage is a huge thing. So they would look at it as yardage gained. And anyone who's like, look at it, see, it's a goal kick.
There is a sort of backstory to it as well. My dad was living in America from the early 90s, 92 he left, and stayed there till he died. And I saw the growth in football when I went out into Pennsylvania, and women's football was enormous in Pennsylvania. Mm. Plus, there was a big void in sport in America, because every sport the Americans did were big. So if you needed to be American football, you had to be huge. Basketball, you had to be huge. So there was a huge population that
baseball
weren't big.
Well. Baseball,
but yeah, all of them, everybody was big. All the American sports were all about big. So there was a big void of people that suddenly got onto soccer and started enjoying it and playing it. And so I saw that early doors, and it wasn't like the 70s when the players went out and got all the money, like a bit what they're doing in Saudi Arabia now. Mm. This was way different. There was a much bigger goal in America to try and bring soccer to America, with the idea of, could, with America's population, one day win the World Cup? Mm. Because they've got such an amazing support and population of Spanish and, you know, South American that would be there, Mexicans, that they could somehow find a way in sport, in soccer, and make a big impact. That's been the drive for 20, 30 years. So I saw the idea of America and got it. It was just weird being part of it because it really did. And until you left the hotel, I mean, even that, I remember at the hotel one day, I was getting the lift, and it was Star Trek convention in the hotel. And I'm standing next to Captain Kirk in the lift with Ray Outen as we're coming out. And they were just asking us what we're doing. I'm talking to Captain Kirk.
I was going to ask if it was simpler days, but it turns out it absolutely was much simpler times. But coming back to the topic of Saudi Arabia, and Gregor, something you talked about, because it's, you know, with the ownership of Premier League clubs, Manchester City, Newcastle, by kind of Middle Eastern states, if you like, or businesses, do you think that for those clubs, because this is a listener question, Trevor Makins got in touch after Monday's show where we talked about the Manchester Derby, and I kind of flippantly said, oh, City were in second gear, weren't they nice? Let's move on and talk about Manchester United. And he said, City don't really get the credit they deserve for football. I'm trying to link it to this topic because does it make it hard, this kind of us talking in big terms around the future of football and this investment and where the money comes from and where the power lies? Does it mean that, as we do with Newcastle, where we kind of say, oh, they're great, but they are owned by, you know, the PIF, etc., does it make it hard for us as journalists to praise the football teams and the football when we're just saying, oh, they've got all the money, they've signed Erling Haaland, etc.?
I think people take their own view on that as a journalist or somebody who watches football. I think, like, personally, we've had this conversation many times, and I have to come to a point where I where I divorce it because I love football and I love watching and analysing the sport in front of me. And I don't like a lot of the things about where football's going and sport more broadly, and Saudi Arabia's investment in, and basically attempted coup of most of it is a big part of that. Mm. But I still love football and what's on the pitch, and you have to at some point divorce yourself from everything else around it. But I would say that we kind of need to be like on guard here, because they've won the World Cup in the space of 18 months?
10 minutes.
Yeah, like, you know, clicked their fingers and they've bought the World Cup. There's no question that they're coming for club football as well. So all the things that Martin's talking about there about, nations and federations, ultimately, you would have to boycott to stop the World Cup going to Saudi Arabia. Clubs do have that, will have that power. Like, they will have that power, but it might come to a point where when they're getting so much money thrown at them and there's so many vested interests, like they already have, they already own Newcastle, where, like, and there's so many, you know, hedge funds, American investment, who, you know, they're there to make money. So if they see, we've already had the Super League attempt, and there's even, you know, some talk
that
there was...
By the way, the driving force for the Super League wasn't actually the money from the Middle East. It was the American venture capitalists and, in league with the big Spanish clubs or whatever. It was the American venture capitalists. So it's all that... I totally agree with you, Greg.
So the club game needs to be on guard. And also, we need to watch, like, because we've already let a lot of people with, you know, a lot of investment into the game who hold the keys to many of our biggest and kind of most famous and vaunted institutions, who will have a say. So,
but
like,
Saudi have already done, they've followed the same model that Qatar did, because Qatar got the World Cup, but even before they got the World Cup, beIN Sports was, you know, getting bigger and bigger, and we're having massive contracts with all of these major European leagues. And then when it all comes together, it's, so do you want to protest about this, or do your clubs like the money from beIN Sports for your overseas rights and stuff like that? And in the end, everyone went, we like the money. Mm. Yeah, we like the money.
Also, how volatile all this is and could be. You know, we saw with Roman Abramovich, like, when something happened, and when the Russia invaded Ukraine, that was gone, that was over. You know, there's you know, a lot of unrest in the Middle East just now. Like, this is all football. It's all so complicated.
Well, it moves so quickly as well. I know I'm only a thick spoke journalist that doesn't understand geopolitics, but if you look at if you look at where this World Cup was meant to be going, if you, from 5 years back, where we all thought it was going, was China. And what has happened in that last 5 years is the balance of power with this investment in sport and football and this takeover has moved away from China and into Saudi Arabia. Why so many English clubs have got Chinese ownership is that a few years ago, our government was very, very keen, very, very keen on Chinese investment in football. It is now very keen on Saudi Arabian investment in football, because I tell you what, if the FA were to try to lead a boycott of the 2034 World Cup, the first phone call would be the Foreign Office on line one saying, what the hell do you think you're doing? Pretty much what happened to the Premier League with the Newcastle takeover, where we know for a fact there was enormous back-channelling going on from the government right to the very top, to put pressure on the Premier League to get this over the line, because we are friends with Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm.
The most depressing thing is that there's the helplessness. Infantino has revealed himself to be more power and by the looks of it, money hungry than even Sepp Blatter before him.
Mm. And if that was indeed possible.
And there's nothing we can do about it.
Yeah. Well, there's a cheery note to end this debate on. You said about divorcing ourselves from this debate sometimes because we love football. And so let's finish on football. One of the things we sometimes fail to do with the nature of our shows being on Mondays and Thursdays is discuss a big game on a Monday. And there's one coming this weekend. Chelsea against Tottenham. Mauricio Pochettino playing against Tottenham with his Chelsea side for the first time. This is a game we picked out, Martin, as one of the big games of the weekend. I want to talk first about Nicholas Jackson, the Chelsea striker. He's been in the news for his kind of interactions with fans, should we say. Tony, I mean, it's to be expected, isn't it? Interactions with supporters, shouting
before
things to
Tony
you.
Before Tony answers this, can I just say that the genesis of this particular question comes from the comment from the crowd that Mauricio Pochettino took exception to, which was somebody shouting at Nicholas Jackson, "Wake up." Now, as someone who's played at Millwall, would "wake up" be one of the tamer comments that you heard in your playing career?
He was really good at Millwall. They all said nice things.
Well, I played for four clubs out of all the other clubs because Villa was lovely. Every fans at Villa were really complimentary of just being nice to you even if you played badly. But I played Millwall, Celtic, Marseille and Chelsea.
Oh, yeah.
Okay? Wake up. Them four in themselves, if I'd have got caught, if I had someone shouting "wake up," I would have probably said, "Well, I've got a flightly today." it's a bit of an understatement, but yeah.
What's the best? What's the worst you heard?
No, well,
is it repeatable?
Honestly, on my second game for Millwall, and I didn't play particularly well in the first, but I'd just been bought for $200,000. I ran out of the old den, and all I heard was, "Cascarino, get that effing piano off your back." So I thought, I'm only in me. This is my own debut. Wow, I've just been paid a record fee by Millwall. And look, as you boys know, you go to Millwall, you're going to hear a lot of abusive, foul language, and it ain't pleasant at times. Of a certain generation, we sort of get on with it. I think it surprises people that are a bit younger when they first go to Millwall. Mm. But I could add a few other clubs in there that, you know, you go to. I always take stick with a pinch of salt, really. I always felt the only way I could change an opinion was by what I did when I crossed the white line and when I played. And if Nicholas Jackson's is getting a wake up, don't worry about it.
Yeah.
Just be more concerned
maybe wake
about
up.
Yeah. Just wake up and get, you know, I find it where we're going down the road where everything's sanitized so much now that even a comment that's even slightly, you know, a bit disingenuous. And we're really going to take that serious?
Mm.
I just think we've got to get real.
Yeah. Well, I said we were going to talk about football, and I've ended up talking about fan abuse off the sideline. But we're edging closer to the pitch. So let's cross that white line and let's get onto the pitch. In terms of the football, it's obviously another big game for Ange Postecoglou, but it's a really big game for Pochettino, isn't it, Martin, in terms of as work. He had a little period with Chelsea where we started going, got a bit about
like
them.
There was
that Arsenal turn, game. Yeah. Yeah. And then we start going, oh, maybe they've not. They lose to Brentford. Where do you think they're at in this season?
The problem is that when it's bad at Chelsea, it doesn't seem to matter what 11 he puts on the pitch. Mm. The problem's all in the same areas, which is slightly worrying. You know, you'd think if you change the personnel, oh, well, the defence is a lot tighter, but we're not getting into the positions, forward positions that we've got. Oh, we look very, very creative, but, you know, we've sacrificed a bit of security at the back. When Chelsea are poor, it doesn't matter what the 11 is, you know, they can't score goals, and the end product isn't quite there. The accuracy of the end product isn't there, and they can't keep a clean sheet. Nicholas Jackson is interesting because when we were talking before, and I made the point that you look at Jackson, he scores 9 in 8. Was it we looked at Gregor? I think it's 9 in 8 in his last 8 games for Villarreal. So he scores just at the time when everyone is preparing for the summer transfer window, just at the time when there's, you know, agents phoning around clubs and saying, "You want to have a look at my boy? He's on fire at the moment," or whatever. But if you look at the rest of the season, I think he scores 4 goals. Mm. So
four
he had this... 4 in 20. Right. So he has this fantastic purple patch at the end of last season. Now, if you're buying a striker, and I know that they had Nkunku and He maybe wouldn't have had as much on his shoulders as he's got at the moment. But if you're buying a striker whose form suggests that he's very, very streaky and that, you know, he needs that momentum, and you're taking him from the Spanish League straight into the Premier League and the elite part of the Premier League as well, there is a chance that he's going to take a few games to get used to that. And he's not going to be able to build that momentum that he suddenly had at the end of last season. Now, it also suggests that at some stage it will come. But it's different. And you just got a little bit, I just felt there was just a little bit of tension in Pochettino taking great umbrage at someone shouting, "Wake up," because it just seemed such a sort of
trivial,
mild thing to say. You're thinking, why has that touched a nerve with the manager?
Tony, we talked earlier about Erik ten Hag and signings and players and people who've improved. Chelsea obviously had a huge influx of players and talent of varying kinds, as Martin's alluded to there with Nicholas Jackson. What have you made of his season so far in terms of players that either he's brought in or that he's inherited, in terms of looking at it and going, he's getting something out of him that he seems to be improving, this potential here?
It's a real tough one because, I mean, watching the Brentford game, I was so concerned that Chelsea had no idea how to get past the block. And that was what Brentford did really well. So they kept getting stuck. And Conor Gallagher, who's a, you know, went out on loan at Crystal Palace, got goals on a regular basis, he's come back to Chelsea and he couldn't get beyond the block. And now Nicholas Jackson's not even holding the ball up. He's not the best shooter in the world. I don't know any boys with the... He's
not
shooting.
The cleanest.
It's really weird for a centre forward. There's no conviction in his strike. Mm. I like the midfield of Gallagher, and when Fernandes is in there and Caicedo, I think that's a really nice balanced midfield. But beyond them, it's very much the two wide guys. I mean, Cole Palmer looks a really good player.
Yeah.
We all knew that anyway. Sterling's very hit and miss, but when he's on, he can get past people. I think it's really tricky for Poch because he hasn't got a team that performed beyond 60 minutes. And that's been really noticeable. I've seen second half against Liverpool in the opening game of the season, remember thinking Chelsea really made it difficult for Liverpool, made Liverpool look quite average at times, and Liverpool aren't, as we know. But I've seen that quite often where they did it against Arsenal, played really, really well against Arsenal for half a game, and second half, you know, they could have ended up losing it. And I think that's a challenge. Look at their games they've got over the next 6-7 games. They're massive challenges for Chelsea because I think he's still spinning plates over a number of positions. Obviously, fullbacks having Reece James out, and I'm still not sure if Kyle Will's as good as what I'm being told, or what everyone leads me to believe that he's going to be a real top player. I still think Thiago Silva's definitely their best defender by a country mile in the heart of their defence. So there's massive challenges. I'm not convinced that Chelsea are going to have a good run up until Christmas. I think they, at the moment, they're probably going to end up where they are now and get beat a few more times.
Gregor, final word from you on Chelsea.
Yeah, I think Reece James obviously came back in last night, and we've said it so many times, him and Chilwell are just so important for them. I think Chilwell's going to be a bit longer. But that even allows, you know, Cucurella has often been playing at right back, although he's a left back, allows him to get in there. And Cole's a centre half, and he's been playing at left back. So it allows them potentially to have a bit more balance in that back four. The thing is,
you said earlier that Hannibal wouldn't have got in any of the Man United teams. Were you saying that Caldwell would have got in any of the Chelsea teams?
No, but I mean that's been a shift because Martin and I were talking about this earlier. The whole project has been about moving on proven winners where there's a bank of evidence that shows what players are capable of. They've played at the highest level for a long, long time, and replacing it all with potential. That's the plan.
Yeah.
And Colwell falls into that category. And you know, I think it'd be fascinating to one day go back through all the Chelsea players that could have been Chelsea players because they had this amazing academy and all it did was generate cash for them, and they farmed them out on loan, so now they're actually getting a chance. And I agree there's more to come from, like we need to see a bit more from him, but I think he's got all the attributes. I think he could be a big player, and there's a reason why he's already been called up for England. But the thing I was going to say was Postecoglou's just making everyone look bad.
That was my final thing. Are Tottenham favourites to win this? We all think Tottenham will win.
Yeah,
you've got a fancy Tottenham, haven't you? You've got a fancy Tottenham.
I got a sneaky feeling that it could end up being a stalemate.
I was going to say, you've got your draw face on. I could see it.
Because all the caveats that we're talking about with all these clubs, with Chelsea, with Man United, you know, they're real, but they were kind of there with Spurs too. And, you know, Postecoglou's come in and just banished them all. It's like, I don't really care about any of that side stuff. I'm not even going to address it. I'll just say, look, I'll just get on with my job and deal with it, mate.
I thought he said something absolutely fantastic when he first took over. And he was asked about his career and with Tottenham, and he said, you know, mate, he said, I've got to be absolutely perfect to this point. He said, because I come from Australia. So if at any stage in my career I hadn't done a good job, I'll do the accent if you want to do it.
Go for it. Come on. Perfect way to finish.
Any stage. If at any stage in my career I'd done a bad job, he said, I've been out. I'd have just been out. That'd have been it. That'd have been because I came from Australia. So I've got no. I can't keep on doing this. it's borderline racist, if not completely racist. But he said that if at any point he'd have messed up, he would never have got another job in football again, because you don't come from North Melbourne and someone goes, oh, we'll give him a second chance. You know, if it had gone wrong for him at Celtic, that would have been it. That would have been it for him in Europe and everything. So he's done a fantastic job. I was very amused the other day to see like a couple of comments and stuff like that, and someone saying, you know, like what Manchester United had got wrong, and, you know, where were they, you know, Postecoglou was available. And I'm thinking, if Manchester United had appointed Ange Postecoglou as their manager, the fans would have gone absolutely berserk. It is the most retrofitted idea I could possibly imagine. Like, now that they're top of the league, everyone could see that Postecoglou was going to be a genius, which it wasn't true when he took over. He thought, he's done a good job at Celtic. You know, he deserves a chance. But no one was saying, oh, Manchester United have missed a trick here, not sacking Ten Hag in the summer and getting Ange Postecoglou in.
It would have been quite the move. And we'll see if Ange Postecoglou can get another win and keep Tottenham top of the table in that game on Monday. We've not mentioned any of the other games on the weekend, but we will be discussing them on Monday's show. So stick with us and make sure you check back in then. Gregor Robertson, Tony Cascarino and Martin Samuel, thank you for joining me. Very good. Nice way to finish, and good day to you as well.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.